Nation. While those who are spoiled with material things are indeed often insufferable, those who are spoiled with affection know themselves to be deeply seductive. This becomes a distinct advantage when they grow up. According to Freud, who was speaking from experience, since he was his mother's darling, spoiled children have a confidence that stays with them all their lives. This quality radiates outward, drawing others to them, and, in a circular process, making people spoil them still more. Since their spirit and natural energy were never tamed by a disciplining parent, as adults they are adventurous and bold, and often impish or brazen. The lesson is simple. It may be too late to be spoiled by a parent, but it is never too late to make other people spoil you. It is all in your attitude. People are drawn to those who expect a lot out of life, whereas they tend to disrespect those who are fearful and undemanding. Wild independence has a provocative effect on us. It appeals to us, while also presenting us with a challenge. We want to be the one to tame it, to make the spirited person dependent on us. Half of seduction is stirring such competitive desires. 3. In October of 1925, Paris society was all excited about the opening of the Revue Nègre. Jazz, or in fact anything that came from Black America, was the latest fashion, and the Broadway dancers and performers who made up the Revue Nègre were African American. On opening night, artists and high society packed the hall. The show was spectacular, as they expected. But nothing prepared them for the last number performed by a somewhat gawky, long-legged woman with the prettiest face, Josephine Baker, a 20-year-old chorus girl from East St. Louis. She came on stage bare-breasted, wearing a skirt of feathers over a satin bikini bottom, with feathers around her neck and ankles. Although she performed her number called Danse Sauvage with another dancer, also clad in feathers, all eyes were riveted on her. Her whole body seemed to come alive in a way the audience had never seen before, her legs moving with the litheness of a cat, her rear end gyrating in patterns that one critic likened to a hummingbird's. As the dance went on, she seemed possessed, feeding off the crowd's ecstatic reaction. And then there was the look on her face. She was having such fun. She radiated a joy that made her erotic dance oddly innocent, even slightly comic. By the following day, word had spread. A star was born. Josephine became the heart of the Revue Nègre, and Paris was at her feet. Within a year, her face was on posters everywhere. There were Josephine Baker perfumes, dolls, clothes. Fashionable French women were slicking their hair back a la Baker, using a product called Baker Fix. They were even trying to darken their skin. Such sudden fame represented quite a change. For just a few years earlier, Josephine had been a young girl growing up in East St. Louis, one of America's worst slums. She had gone to work at the age of 8, cleaning houses for a white woman who beat her. She had sometimes slept in a rat-infested basement. There had never been heat in the winter. She had taught herself to dance in her wild fashion to help keep herself warm. In 1919, Josephine had run away and become a part-time vaudeville performer, landing in New York 2 years later without money or connections. She had had some success as a clowning chorus girl, providing comic relief with her crossed eyes and screwed-up face, but she hadn't stood out. Then she was invited to Paris. Some other black performers had declined, fearing things might be still worse for them in France than in America, but Josephine jumped at the chance. Despite her success with the Revue Nègre, Josephine did not delude herself. Parisians were notoriously fickle. She decided to turn the relationship around. First, she refused to be aligned with any club, and developed a reputation for breaking contracts at will, making it clear that she was ready to leave in an instant. Since childhood, she had been afraid of dependence on anyone. Now, no one could take her for granted. This only made impresarios chase her, and the public appreciate her the more. Second, she was aware that although black culture had become the vogue, what the French had fallen in love with was a kind of caricature. If that was what it took to be successful, so be it. But Josephine made it clear that she didn't take the caricature seriously. Instead, she reversed it, becoming the ultimate Frenchwoman of fashion, a caricature not of blackness, but of whiteness. Everything was a role to play, the comedienne, the primitive dancer, the ultra-stylish Parisian. And everything Josephine did, she did with such a light spirit, such a lack of pretension, that she continued to seduce the jaded French for years. Her funeral in 1975 was nationally televised, a huge cultural event. She was buried with the kind of pomp normally reserved only for heads of state. From very early on, Josephine Baker couldn't stand the feeling of having no control over the world. Yet what could she do in the face of her uncompromising circumstances? Some young girls put all their hope on a husband, but Josephine's father had left her mother soon after she was born, and she saw marriage as something that would only make her more miserable. Her solution was something children often do. Confronted with a hopeless environment, she closed herself off in a world of her own making, oblivious to the ugliness around her. This world was filled with dancing, clowning, dreams of great things. Let other people wail and moan. Josephine would smile, remain confident and self-reliant. Almost everyone who met her, from her earliest years to her last, commented on how seductive this quality was. Her refusal to compromise or to be what she was expected to be made everything she did seem authentic and natural. A child loves to play and to create a little self-contained world. When children are absorbed in make-believe, they are hopelessly charming. They infuse their imaginings with such seriousness and feeling. Adult naturals do something similar, particularly if they are artists. They create their own fantasy world and live in it as if it were the real one. Fantasy is so much more pleasant than reality, and since most people don't have the power or courage to create such a world, they enjoy being around those who do. Remember, the role you were given in life is not the role you have to accept. You can always live out a role of your own creation, a role that fits your fantasy. Learn to play with your image, never taking it too seriously. The key is to infuse your play with the conviction and feeling of a child, making it seem natural. The more absorbed you seem in your own joy-filled world, the more seductive you become. Don't go halfway. Make the fantasy you inhabit as radical and exotic as possible, and you will attract attention like a magnet. 4. It was the festival of the cherry blossom at the Heian court in late 10th century Japan. In the emperor's palace, many of the courtiers were drunk, and others were fast asleep, but the young princess Oborozukiyo, the emperor's sister-in-law, was awake and reciting a poem. What can compare with the misty moon of spring? Her voice was smooth and delicate. She moved to the door of her apartment to look at the moon. Then suddenly she smelled something sweet, and a hand clutched the sleeve of her robe. "Who are you?" she said, frightened. "There's nothing to be afraid of," came a man's voice, and continued with a poem of his own. "Late in the night we enjoy a misty moon. There is nothing misty about the bond between us." Without another word, the man pulled the princess to him and picked her up, carrying her into a gallery outside her room, sliding the door closed behind him. She was terrified and tried to call for help. In the darkness, she heard him say, a little louder now, "It will do you no good. I am always allowed my way. Just be quiet, if you will, please." Now, the princess recognized the voice and the scent. It was Genji, the young son of the late emperor's concubine, whose robes bore a distinctive perfume. This calmed her somewhat, since the man was someone she knew, but on the other hand she also knew of his reputation. Genji was the court's most incorrigible seducer, a man who stopped at nothing. He was drunk, it was near dawn, and the watchmen would soon be on their rounds. She didn't want to be discovered with him. But then she began to make out the outlines of his face. So pretty, his look so sincere, without a trace of malice. Then came more poems, recited in that charming voice, the words so insinuating. The images he conjured filled her mind and distracted her from his hands. She could not resist him. As the light began to rise, Genji got to his feet. He said a few tender words, they exchanged fans, and then he quickly left. The serving women were coming through the emperor's rooms by now, and when they saw Genji scurrying away, the perfume of his robes lingering after him, they smiled, knowing he was up to his usual tricks. But they never imagined he would dare approach the sister of the emperor's wife. In the days that followed, Oborozukiyo could only think of Genji. She knew he had other mistresses, but when she tried to put him out of her mind, a letter from him would arrive, and she would be back to square one. In truth, she had started the correspondence, haunted by his midnight visit. She had to see him again. Despite the risk of discovery and the fact that her sister Kokiden, the emperor's wife, hated Genji, she arranged for further trysts in her apartment. But one night, an envious courtier found them together. Word reached Kokiden, who naturally was furious. She demanded that Genji be banished from court, and the emperor had no choice but to agree. Genji went far away, and things settled down. Then the emperor died, and his son took over. A kind of emptiness had come to the court. The dozens of women whom Genji had seduced could not endure his absence and flooded him with letters. Even women who had never known him intimately would weep over any relic he had left behind, a robe, for instance, in which his scent still lingered. And the young emperor missed his jocular presence, and the princesses missed the music he had played on the koto, and Oborozukiyo pined for his midnight visits. Finally, even Kokiden broke down, realizing that she couldn't resist him. So Genji was summoned back to the court, and not only was he forgiven, he was given a hero's welcome. The young emperor himself greeted the scoundrel with tears in his eyes. The story of Genji's life is told in the 11th century novel The Tale of Genji, written by Murasaki Shikibu, a woman of the Heian court. The character was most likely based on a real-life man, Fujiwara no Korechika. Indeed, another book of the period, The Pillow Book of Sei Shonagon, describes an encounter between the female author and Korechika, and reveals his incredible charm and his almost hypnotic effect on women. Genji is a natural, an undefensive lover, a man who has a lifelong obsession with women, but whose appreciation of and affection for them makes him irresistible. As he says to Oborozukiyo in the novel, I am always allowed my way. This self-belief is half of Genji's charm. Resistance doesn't make him defensive. He retreats gracefully, reciting a little poetry, and as he leaves, the perfume of his robes trailing behind him, his victim wonders why she has been so afraid, and what she is missing by spurning him, and she finds a way to let him know that the next time things will be different. Genji takes nothing seriously or personally, and at the age of 40, an age at which most men of the 11th century were already looking old and worn, he still seems like a boy. His seductive powers never leave him. Human beings are immensely suggestible. Their moods will easily spread to the people around them. In fact, seduction depends on mimesis, on the conscious creation of a mood or feeling that is then reproduced by the other person. But hesitation and awkwardness are also contagious, and are deadly to seduction. If, in a key moment, you seem indecisive or self-conscious, the other person will sense that you're thinking of yourself, instead of being overwhelmed by his or her charms. The spell will be broken. As an undefensive lover, though, you produce the opposite effect. Your victim might be hesitant or worried, but confronted with someone so sure and natural, he or she will be caught up in the mood. Like dancing with someone you lead effortlessly across the dance floor, it is a skill you can learn. It's a matter of rooting out the fear and awkwardness that have built up in you over the years, of becoming more graceful with your approach, less defensive when others seem to resist. Often, people's resistance is a way of testing you, and if you show any awkwardness or hesitation, you not only will fail the test, but you will risk infecting them with your doubts. Dangers. A childish quality can be charming, but it can also be irritating. The innocent have no experience of the world, and their sweetness can prove cloying. In Milan Kundera's novel, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, the hero dreams that he is trapped on an island with a group of children. Soon, their wonderful qualities become intensely annoying to him. After a few days of exposure to them, he cannot relate to them at all. The dream turns into a nightmare, and he longs to be back among adults, with real things to do and talk about. Because total childishness can quickly grate, the most seductive naturals are those who, like Josephine Baker, combine adult experience and wisdom with a childlike manner. It is this mixture of qualities that is most alluring. Society cannot tolerate too many naturals. Given a crowd of Cora Pearls or Charlie Chaplins, their charm would quickly wear off. In any case, it's usually only artists or people with abundant leisure time who can afford to go all the way. The best way to use the natural character type is in specific situations when a touch of innocence or impishness will help lower your target's defenses. A con man plays dumb to make the other person trust him and feel superior. This kind of feigned naturalness has countless applications in daily life, where nothing is more dangerous than looking smarter than the next person. The natural pose is the perfect way to disguise your cleverness, but if you are uncontrollably childish and cannot turn it off, you run the risk of seeming pathetic, earning not sympathy, but pity and disgust. Similarly, the seductive traits of the natural work best in one who is still young enough for them to seem natural. They are much harder for an older person to pull off. Cora Pearl didn't seem so charming when she was still wearing her pink flouncy dresses in her 50s. The Duke of Buckingham, who seduced everyone in the English court in the 1620s, including the homosexual King James I himself, was wondrously childish in looks and manner, but this became obnoxious and off-putting as he grew older, and he eventually made enough enemies that he ended up being murdered. As you age, then, your natural qualities should suggest more the child's open spirit, less an innocence that will no longer convince anyone. In conclusion, here are some further reflections on the natural. From the standard edition of the Complete Psychological Works of Sigmund Freud, volume 23. Long past ages have a great and often puzzling attraction for men's imagination. Whenever they are dissatisfied with their present surroundings, and this happens often enough, they turn back to the past and hope that they will now be able to prove the truth of the inextinguishable dream of a golden age. They are probably still under the spell of their childhood, which is presented to them by their not impartial memory as a time of uninterrupted bliss. From The Greek Myths by Robert Graves. When Hermes was born on Mount Selene, his mother, Maia, laid him in swaddling bands on a winnowing fan. But he grew with astonishing quickness into a little boy, and as soon as her back was turned, slipped off and went looking for adventure. Arrived at Pieria, where Apollo was tending a fine herd of cows, he decided to steal them. But fearing to be betrayed by their tracks, he quickly made a number of shoes from the bark of a fallen oak, and tied them with plaited grass to the feet of the cows, which he then drove off by night along the road. Apollo discovered the loss, but Hermes' trick deceived him, and though he went as far as Pylos in his westward search, and to Onchestus in his eastern, he was forced in the end to offer a reward for the apprehension of the thief. Silenus and his satyrs, greedy of reward, spread out in different directions to track him down, but for a long while, without success. At last, as a party of them passed through Arcadia, they heard the muffled sound of music such as they had never heard before, and the nymph Silene, from the mouth of a cave, told them that a most gifted child had recently been born there, to whom she was acting as nurse. He had constructed an ingenious musical toy from the shell of a tortoise and some cowgut, with which he had lulled his mother to sleep. "And from whom did he get the cowgut?" asked the alert satyrs, noticing two hides stretched outside the cave. "Do you charge the poor child with theft?" asked Silene. Harsh words were exchanged. At that moment, Apollo came up, having discovered the thief's identity by observing the suspicious behavior of a long-winged bird. Entering the cave, he awakened Maia and told her severely that Hermes must restore the stolen cows. Maia pointed to the child, still wrapped in his swaddling bands and feigning sleep. "What an absurd charge," she cried. But Apollo had already recognized the hides. He picked up Hermes, carried him to Olympus, and there formally accused him of theft, offering the hides as evidence. Zeus, loath to believe that his own newborn son was a thief, encouraged him to plead not guilty. But Apollo would not be put off, and Hermes at last weakened and confessed. "Very well, come with me," he said, "and you may have your herd. I slaughtered only two, and those I cut up into 12 equal portions as a sacrifice to the 12 gods."
12 gods?" asked Apollo. "Who is the 12th?
"Your servant, sir," replied Hermes modestly. "I ate no more than my share, though I was very hungry, and duly burned the rest." The two gods, Hermes and Apollo, returned to Mount Selene, where Hermes greeted his mother and retrieved something that he had hidden underneath a sheepskin.
"What have you there?" asked Apollo.
In answer, Hermes showed his newly invented tortoise-shell lyre, and played such a ravishing tune on it with the plectrum he had also invented, at the same time singing in praise of Apollo's nobility, intelligence, and generosity, that he was forgiven at once. He led the surprised and delighted Apollo to Pylos, playing all the way, and there gave him the remainder of the cattle which he had hidden in a cave.
"A bargain," cried Apollo. "You keep the cows, and I take the lyre."
"Agreed," said Hermes, and they shook hands on it. Apollo, taking the child back to Olympus, told Zeus all that had happened. Zeus warned Hermes that henceforth he must respect the rights of property and refrain from telling downright lies, but he could not help being amused.
"You seem to be a very ingenious, eloquent, and persuasive godling," he said.
"Then make me your herald, father," Hermes answered, "and I will be responsible for the safety of all divine property and never tell lies, though I cannot promise always to tell the whole truth."
"That would not be expected of you," said Zeus with a smile. Zeus gave him a herald's staff with white ribbons, which everyone was ordered to respect, a round hat against the rain, and winged golden sandals, which carried him about with the swiftness of the wind.
From Love by Stendhal. A man may meet a woman and be shocked by her ugliness. Soon, if she is natural and unaffected, her expression makes him overlook the fault of her features. He begins to find her charming. It enters his head
that she might be loved, and a week later, he is living in hope. The following week, he has been snubbed into despair, and the week afterwards, he has gone mad. From Notes of a Film Director by Sergei Eisenstein. Geographical escapism has been rendered ineffective by the spread of air routes. What remains is evolutionary escapism, a downward course in one's development, back to the ideas and emotions of golden childhood, which may well be defined as regress towards infantilism, escape to a personal world of childish ideas. In a strictly regulated society, where life follows strictly defined canons, the urge to escape from the chain of things established once and for all must be felt particularly strongly. And the most perfect of comedians does this with utmost perfection, for Chaplin serves this principle through the subtlety of his method, which, offering the spectator an infantile pattern to be imitated, psychologically infects him with infantilism and draws him into the golden age of the infantile paradise of childhood. A quote from Gustave Claudin, a contemporary of Cora Pearl. Prince Gortchakov used to say that she was the last word in luxury, and that he would have tried to steal the sum to satisfy one of her whims. From Influencing Human Behavior by Professor H. A. Overstreet. Apparently, the possession of humor implies the possession of a number of typical habit systems. The first is an emotional one, the habit of playfulness. Why should one be proud of being playful? For a double reason. First, playfulness connotes childhood and youth. If one can be playful, one still possesses something of the vigor and the joy of young life. But there is a deeper implication. To be playful is, in a sense, to be free. When a person is playful, he momentarily disregards the binding necessities which compel him in business and morals, in domestic and community life. What galls us is that the binding necessities do not permit us to shape our world as we please. What we most deeply desire, however, is to create our world for ourselves. Whenever we can do that, even in the slightest degree, we are happy. Now, in play, we create our own world. From The Tale of Genji by Murasaki Shikibu. All was quiet again. Genji slipped the latch open and tried the doors. They had not been bolted. A curtain had been set up just inside, and in the dim light he could make out Chinese chests and other furniture scattered in some disorder. He made his way through to her side. She lay by herself, a slight little figure. Though vaguely annoyed at being disturbed, she evidently took him for the woman Chujo, until he pulled back the covers. His manner was so gently persuasive that devils and demons could not have gainsaid him. She was so small that he lifted her easily. As he passed through the doors to his own room, he came upon Chujo, who had been summoned earlier. He called out in surprise. Surprised in turn, Chujo peered into the darkness. The perfume that came from his robes like a cloud of smoke told her who he was. Chujo followed after, but Genji was quite unmoved by her pleas. "Come for her in the morning," he said, sliding the doors closed. The lady was bathed in perspiration and quite beside herself at the thought of what Chujo and the others too would be thinking. Genji had to feel sorry for her. Yet the sweet words poured forth, the whole gamut of pretty devices for making a woman surrender. One may imagine that he found many kind promises with which to comfort her. The Coquette. The ability to delay satisfaction is the ultimate art of seduction. While waiting, the victim is held in thrall. Coquettes are the grand masters of this game, orchestrating a back-and-forth movement between hope and frustration. They bait with the promise of reward, the hope of physical pleasure, happiness, fame by association, power, all of which, however, proves elusive. Yet this only makes their targets pursue them more. Coquettes seem totally self-sufficient. They don't need you, they seem to say, and their narcissism proves devilishly attractive. You want to conquer them, but they hold the cards. The strategy of the coquette is never to offer total satisfaction. Initiate the alternating heat and coolness of the coquette, and you will keep the seduced at your heels. The Hot and Cold Coquette. In the autumn of 1795, Paris was caught up in a strange giddiness. The reign of terror that had followed the French Revolution had ended. The sound of the guillotine was gone. The city breathed a collective sigh of relief and gave way to wild parties and endless festivals. The young Napoleon Bonaparte, 26 at the time, had no interest in such revelries. He had made a name for himself as a bright, audacious general who had helped quell rebellion in the provinces. But his ambition was boundless, and he burned with desire for new conquests. So when, in October of that year, the infamous 33-year-old widow, Josephine de Beauharnais, visited his office, he couldn't help but be confused. Josephine was so exotic, and everything about her was languorous and sensual. She capitalized on her foreignness. She came from the island of Martinique. On the other hand, she had a reputation as a loose woman, and the shy Napoleon believed in marriage. Even so, when Josephine invited him to one of her weekly soirées, he found himself accepting. At the soirée, he felt totally out of his element. All of the city's great writers and wits were there, as well as the few of the nobility who had survived. Josephine herself was a vicomtesse and had narrowly escaped the guillotine. The women were dazzling, some of them more beautiful than the hostess. But all the men congregated around Josephine, drawn by her graceful presence and queenly manner. Several times she left the men behind and went to Napoleon's side. Nothing could have flattered his insecure ego more than such attention. He began to pay her visits. Sometimes she would ignore him, and he would leave in a fit of anger. Yet the next day a passionate letter would arrive from Josephine, and he would rush to see her. Soon he was spending most of his time with her. Her occasional shows of sadness, her bouts of anger or of tears, only deepened his attachment. In March of 1796, Napoleon married Josephine. 2 days after his wedding, Napoleon left to lead a campaign in northern Italy against the Austrians. "You are the constant object of my thoughts," he wrote to his wife from abroad. "My imagination exhausts itself in guessing what you're doing." His generals saw him distracted. He would leave meetings early, spend hours writing letters, or stare at the miniature of Josephine he wore around his neck. He had been driven to this state by the unbearable distance between them and by a slight coldness he now detected in her. She wrote infrequently, and her letters lacked passion. Nor did she join him in Italy. He had to finish his war fast so that he could return to her side. Engaging the enemy with unusual zeal, he began to make mistakes. "To live for Josephine," he wrote to her. "I work to get near you. I kill myself to reach you." His letters became more passionate and erotic. A friend of Josephine who saw them wrote, "The handwriting was almost indecipherable, the spelling shaky, the style bizarre and confused. What a position for a woman to find herself in, being the motivating force behind the triumphal march of an entire army." Months went by in which Napoleon begged Josephine to come to Italy, and she made endless excuses. But finally, she agreed to come and left Paris for Brescia, where he was headquartered. A near encounter with the enemy along the way, however, forced her to detour to Milan. Napoleon was away from Brescia in battle. When he returned to find her still absent, he blamed his foe, General Wurmser, and swore revenge. For the next few months he seemed to pursue two targets with equal energy, Wurmser and Josephine. His wife was never where she was supposed to be. I reach Milan, rush to your house, having thrown aside everything in order to clasp you in my arms. You are not there, he wrote. Napoleon would turn angry and jealous, but when he finally caught up with Josephine, the slightest of her favors melted his heart. He took long rides with her in a darkened carriage, while his generals fumed. Meetings were missed, orders and strategies improvised. Never, he later wrote to her, has a woman been in such complete mastery of another's heart. And yet, their time together was so short. During a campaign that lasted almost a year, Napoleon spent a mere 15 nights with his new bride. Napoleon later heard rumors that Josephine had taken a lover while he was in Italy. His feelings toward her cooled, and he himself took an endless series of mistresses. Yet Josephine was never really concerned about this threat to her power over her husband. A few tears, some theatrics, a little coldness on her part, and he remained her slave. In 1804, he had her crowned empress, and had she borne him a son, she would have remained empress to the end. When Napoleon lay on his deathbed, the last word he uttered was Josephine. During the French Revolution, Josephine had come within minutes of losing her head on the guillotine. The experience left her without illusions and with two goals in mind: to live a life of pleasure and to find the man who could best supply it. She set her sights on Napoleon early on. He was young and had a brilliant future. Beneath his calm exterior, Josephine sensed, he was highly emotional and aggressive, but this didn't intimidate her. It only revealed his insecurity and weakness. He would be easy to enslave. First, Josephine adapted to his moods, charmed him with her feminine grace, warmed him with her looks and manner. He wanted to possess her, and once she had aroused this desire, her power lay in postponing its satisfaction, withdrawing from him, frustrating him. In fact, the torture of the chase gave Napoleon a masochistic pleasure. He yearned to subdue her independent spirit, as if she were an enemy in battle. People are inherently perverse. An easy conquest has a lower value than a difficult one. We're only really excited by what is denied us, by what we cannot possess in full. Your greatest power in seduction is your ability to turn away, to make others come after you, delaying their satisfaction. Most people miscalculate and surrender too soon, worried that the other person will lose interest, or that giving the other what he or she wants will grant the giver a kind of power. The truth is the opposite. Once you satisfy someone, you no longer have the initiative, and you open yourself to the possibility that he or she will lose interest at the slightest whim. Remember, vanity is critical in love. Make your targets afraid that you may be withdrawing, that you may not really be interested, and you arouse their innate insecurity, their fear that as you have gotten to know them, they have become less exciting to you. These insecurities are devastating. Then, once you have made them uncertain of you and of themselves, reignite their hope, making them feel desired again. Hot and cold, hot and cold. Such coquetry is perversely pleasurable, heightening interest and keeping the initiative on your side. Never be put off by your target's anger. It is a sure sign of enslavement. The Cold Coquette. In 1952, the writer Truman Capote, a recent success in literary and social circles, began to receive an almost daily barrage of fan mail from a young man named Andy Warhol. An illustrator for shoe designers, fashion magazines, and the like, Warhol made pretty, stylized drawings, some of which he sent to Capote, hoping the author would include them in one of his books. Capote did not respond. One day he came home to find Warhol talking to his mother, with whom Capote lived, and Warhol began to telephone almost daily. Finally, Capote put an end to all this. He seemed one of those hopeless people that you just know nothing's ever going to happen to. Just a hopeless, born loser, the writer later said. 10 years later, Andy Warhol, aspiring artist, had his first one-man show at the Stable Gallery in Manhattan. On the walls were a series of silk-screened paintings based on the Campbell soup can and the Coca-Cola bottle. At the opening, and at the party afterward, Warhol stood to the side, staring blankly, talking little. What a contrast he was to the older generation of artists, the abstract expressionists, mostly hard-drinking womanizers full of bluster and aggression, big talkers who had dominated the art scene for the previous 15 years. And what a change from the Warhol who had badgered Capote, and art dealers and patrons as well. The critics were both baffled and intrigued by the coldness of Warhol's work. They could not figure out how the artist felt about his subjects. What was his position? What was he trying to say? When they asked, he would simply reply, "I just do it because I like it," or "I love soup." The critics went wild with their interpretations. An art like Warhol's is necessarily parasitic upon the myths of its time, one wrote. Another, "The decision not to decide is a paradox that is equal to an idea which expresses nothing but then gives it dimension." The show was a huge success, establishing Warhol as a leading figure in a new movement, pop art. In 1963, Warhol rented a large Manhattan loft space that he called the Factory, and that soon became the hub of a large entourage, hangers-on, actors, aspiring artists. Here, particularly at night, Warhol would simply wander about or stand in a corner. People would gather around him, fight for his attention, throw questions at him, and he would answer in his non-committal way, but no one could get close to him. Physically or mentally, he would not allow it. At the same time, if he walked by you without giving you his usual, "Oh, hi," you were devastated. He hadn't noticed you. Perhaps you were on the way out. Increasingly interested in filmmaking, Warhol cast his friends in his movies. In effect, he was offering them a kind of instant celebrity, their 15 minutes of fame. The phrase is Warhol's. Soon people were competing for roles. He groomed women in particular for stardom. Edie Sedgwick, Viva, Nico. Just being around him offered a kind of celebrity by association. The Factory became the place to be seen, and stars like Judy Garland and Tennessee Williams would go to parties there, rubbing elbows with Sedgwick, Viva, and the bohemian lower echelons whom Warhol had befriended. People began sending limos to bring him to parties of their own. His presence alone was enough to turn a social evening into a scene, even though he would pass through in near silence, keeping to himself and leaving early. In 1967, Warhol was asked to lecture at various colleges. He hated to talk, particularly about his own art. "The less something has to say," he felt, "the more perfect it is." But the money was good, and Warhol always found it hard to say no. His solution was simple. He asked an actor, Alan Meget, to impersonate him. Meget was dark-haired, tan, part Cherokee Indian. He did not resemble Warhol in the least, but Warhol and friends covered his face with powder, sprayed his brown hair silver, gave him dark glasses, and dressed him in Warhol's clothes. Since Meget knew nothing about art, his answers to students' questions tended to be as short and enigmatic as Warhol's own. The impersonation worked. Warhol may have been an icon, but no one really knew him. And since he often wore dark glasses, even his face was unfamiliar in any detail. The lecture audiences were far enough away to be teased by the thought of his presence, and no one got close enough to catch the deception. He remained elusive. Early on in life, Andy Warhol was plagued by conflicting emotions. He desperately wanted fame, but he was naturally passive and shy. I've always had a conflict, he later said, because I'm shy and yet I like to take up a lot of personal space. Mom always said, don't be pushy, but let everyone know you're around. At first, Warhol tried to make himself more aggressive, straining to please and court. It didn't work. After 10 futile years, he stopped trying and gave in to his own passivity, only to discover the power that withdrawal commands. Warhol began this process in his artwork, which changed dramatically in the early 1960s. His new paintings of soup cans, green stamps, and other widely known images did not assault you with meaning. In fact, their meaning was totally elusive, which only heightened their fascination. They drew you in by their immediacy, their visual power, their coldness. Having transformed his art, Warhol also transformed himself. Like his paintings, he became pure surface. He trained himself to hold himself back, to stop talking. The world is full of people who try, people who impose themselves aggressively. They may gain temporary victories, but the longer they are around, the more people want to confound them. They leave no space around themselves, and without space there can be no seduction. Cold coquettes create space by remaining elusive and making others pursue them. Their coolness suggests a comfortable confidence that it's exciting to be around, even though it may not actually exist. Their silence makes you want to talk. Their self-containment, their appearance of having no need for other people, only makes us want to do things for them, hungry for the slightest sign of recognition and favor. Cold coquettes may be maddening to deal with, never committing, but never saying no, never allowing closeness, but more often than not, we find ourselves coming back to them, addicted to the coldness they project. Remember, seduction is a process of drawing people in, making them want to pursue and possess you. Seem distant, and people will go mad to win your favor. Humans, like nature, hate a vacuum. An emotional distance and silence make them strain to fill up the empty space with words and heat of their own. Like Warhol, stand back and let them fight over you. Keys to the character. According to the popular concept, coquettes are consummate teases. Experts at arousing desire through a provocative appearance or an alluring attitude. But the real essence of coquettes is in fact their ability to trap people emotionally and to keep their victims in their clutches long after that first titillation of desire. This is the skill that puts them in the ranks of the most effective seducers. Their success may seem somewhat odd, since they're essentially cold and distant creatures. Should you ever get to know one well, you will sense his or her inner core of detachment and self-love. It may seem logical that once you become aware of this quality, you will see through the coquette's manipulations and lose interest. But more often, we see the opposite. After years of Josephine's coquettish games, Napoleon was well aware of how manipulative she was. Yet this conqueror of kingdoms, this skeptic and cynic, could not leave her. To understand the peculiar power of the coquette, you must first understand a critical property of love and desire. The more obviously you pursue a person, the more likely you are to chase them away. Too much attention can be interesting for a while, but it soon grows cloying and finally becomes claustrophobic and frightening. It signals weakness and neediness, an unseductive combination. How often we make this mistake, thinking our persistent presence will reassure. But coquettes have an inherent understanding of this particular dynamic. Masters of selective withdrawal, they hint at coldness, absenting themselves at times to keep their victim off balance, surprised, intrigued. Their withdrawals make them mysterious, and we build them up in our imaginations. Familiarity, on the other hand, undermines what we have built. A bout of distance engages the emotions further. Instead of making us angry, it makes us insecure. Perhaps they don't really like us. Perhaps we have lost their interest. Once our vanity is at stake, we succumb to the coquette just to prove we are still desirable. Remember, the essence of the coquette lies not in the tease and temptation, but in the subsequent step back, the emotional withdrawal. That is the key to enslaving desire. To adopt the power of the coquette, you must understand one other quality: narcissism. Sigmund Freud characterized the, quote, narcissistic woman, most often obsessed with her appearance, as the type with the greatest effect on men. As children, he explains, we pass through a narcissistic phase that is immensely pleasurable. Happily self-contained and self-involved, we have little psychic need of other people. Then, slowly, we are socialized and taught to pay attention to others, but we secretly yearn for those blissful early days. The narcissistic woman reminds a man of that period and makes him envious. Perhaps contact with her will restore that feeling of self-involvement. A man is also challenged by the female coquette's independence. He wants to be the one to make her dependent, to burst her bubble. It is far more likely, though, that he will end up becoming her slave, giving her incessant attention to gain her love and failing. For the narcissistic woman is not emotionally needy. She is self-sufficient, and this is surprisingly seductive. Self-esteem is critical in seduction. Your attitude towards yourself is read by the other person in subtle and unconscious ways. Low self-esteem repels. Confidence and self-sufficiency attract. The less you seem to need other people, the more likely others will be drawn to you. Understand the importance of this in all relationships, and you will find your neediness easier to suppress. But do not confuse self-absorption with seductive narcissism. Talking endlessly about yourself is eminently anti-seductive, revealing not self-sufficiency, but insecurity. The coquette is traditionally thought of as female, and certainly the strategy was for centuries one of the few weapons women had to engage and enslave a man's desire. One ploy of the coquette is the withdrawal of sexual favors, and we see women using this trick throughout history. The great 17th century French courtesan, Ninon de l'Enclos, was desired by all the preeminent men of France, but only attained real power when she made it clear that she would no longer sleep with a man as part of her duty. This drove her admirers to despair, which she knew how to make worse by favoring a man temporarily, granting him access to her body for a few months, then returning him to the pack of the unsatisfied. Queen Elizabeth I of England took coquettishness to the extreme, deliberately arousing the desires of her courtiers, but sleeping with none of them. Long a tool of social power for women, coquettishness was slowly adapted by men, particularly the great seducers of the 17th and 18th centuries, who envied the power of such women. One 17th century seducer, the Duc de Lauzun, was a master at exciting a woman, then suddenly acting aloof. Women went wild over him. Today, coquetry is genderless. In a world that discourages direct confrontation, teasing, coldness, and selective aloofness are a form of indirect power that brilliantly disguises its own aggression. The coquette must first and foremost be able to excite the target of his or her attention. The attraction can be sexual, the lure of celebrity, whatever it takes. At the same time, the coquette sends contrary signals that stimulate contrary responses, plunging the victim into confusion. The eponymous heroine of Marivaux's 18th century French novel, Marianne, is the consummate coquette. Going to church, she dresses tastefully, but leaves her hair slightly uncombed. In the middle of the service, she seems to notice this error and starts to fix it, revealing her bare arm as she does so. Such things were not to be seen in an 18th-century church, and all male eyes fix on her for that moment. The tension is much more powerful than if she were outside or were tardily dressed. Remember, obvious flirting will reveal your intentions too clearly. Better to be ambiguous and even contradictory, frustrating at the same time that you stimulate. The great spiritual leader, Jiddu Krishnamurti, was an unconscious coquette. Revered by theosophists as their world teacher, Krishnamurti was also a dandy. He loved elegant clothing and was devilishly handsome. At the same time, he practiced celibacy and had a horror of being touched. In 1929, he shocked theosophists around the world by proclaiming that he was not a god or even a guru and did not want any followers. This only heightened his appeal. Women fell in love with him in great numbers, and his advisors grew even more devoted. Physically and psychologically, Krishnamurti was sending contrary signals. While preaching a generalized love and acceptance in his personal life, he pushed people away. His attractiveness and his obsession with his appearance might have gained him attention, but by themselves would not have made women fall in love with him. His lessons of celibacy and spiritual virtue would have created disciples, but not physical love. The combination of these traits, however, both drew people in and frustrated them, a coquettish dynamic that created an emotional and physical attachment to a man who shunned such things. His withdrawal from the world had the effect of only heightening the devotion of his followers. Coquetry depends on developing a pattern to keep the other person off balance. The strategy is extremely effective. Experiencing a pleasure once, we yearn to repeat it, so the coquette gives us pleasure, then withdraws it. The alternation of heat and cold is the most common pattern and has several variations. The 8th century Chinese coquette, Yang Guifei, totally enslaved the Emperor Ming Huang through a pattern of kindness and bitterness. Having charmed him with kindness, she would suddenly get angry, blaming him harshly for the slightest mistake. Unable to live without the pleasure she gave him, the Emperor would turn the court upside down to please her when she was angry or upset. Her tears had a similar effect. What had he done? Why was she so sad? He eventually ruined himself and his kingdom trying to keep her happy. Tears, anger, and the production of guilt are all the tools of the coquette. A similar dynamic appears in a lover's quarrel. When a couple fights, then reconciles, the joys of reconciliation only make the attachment stronger. Sadness of any sort is also seductive, particularly if it seems deep-rooted, even spiritual, rather than needy or pathetic. It makes people come to you. Coquettes are never jealous. That would undermine their image of fundamental self-sufficiency. But they are masters at inciting jealousy. By paying attention to a third party, creating a triangle of desire, they signal to their victims that they may not be that interested. This triangulation is extremely seductive, in social contexts as well as erotic ones. Interested in narcissistic women, Freud was a narcissist himself, and his aloofness drove his disciples crazy. They even had a name for it, his, quote, God complex. Behaving like a kind of messiah, too lofty for petty emotions, Freud always maintained a distance between himself and his students, hardly ever inviting them over for dinner, say, and keeping his private life shrouded in mystery. Yet, he would occasionally choose an acolyte to confide in. Carl Jung, Otto Rank, Lou Andreas Salome. The result was that his disciples went berserk trying to win his favor, to be the one he chose. Their jealousy when he suddenly favored one of them only increased his power over them. People's natural insecurities are heightened in group settings. By maintaining aloofness, coquettes start a competition to win their favor. If the ability to use third parties to make targets jealous is a critical seductive skill, Sigmund Freud was a grand coquette. All of the tactics of the coquette have been adapted by political leaders to make the public fall in love. While exciting the masses, these leaders